Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, everybody. I'm Marcus Spella. Welcome to the Barcelona Legacy podcast. This is the third of a six-part series to coincide with the release of The Barcelona Legacy, a book that explores how the evolution of today's game begins at Barcelona 25 years ago with the pioneering ideas of Johan Cruyff and was taken on by the likes of Louis van Gaal, Jose Mourinho and Pep Guardiola. It's written by one of our panellists, Jonathan Wilson, who writes for The Guardian, Sports Illustrated and World Soccer, and it's out this month in hardback, ebook and audiobook. We're also joined today by John Bruin, who is a freelance football journalist. So, Jonathan, in this podcast series, we're looking at six matches that define this footballing evolution from Cruyff's Barcelona to Guardiola's Manchester City. This time, we're focusing on Chelsea versus Barcelona in the Champions League last 16 in 2005. Jonathan, why have you chosen this fixture?
Well, there's a bit of a leap, I think, from the last one we did, which was 1994 Champions League final. Mm-hmm. So in that period, you have Cruyff leaves, which we talked about a lot last time. Mm-hmm. Louis van Gaal comes in, is moderately successful, falls out with everybody, as he does. They then have an interregnum before he comes back of Laurent Stauffer and Charlie Rexach, which just doesn't work at all. Mm. Van Gaal coming back was disastrous. So Barcelona, at that point, are in a very low ebb. Van Gaal is then sacked, and in comes Frank Rijkaard, slightly strangely, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. Mm-hmm. And so this is the beginning of Rijkaard laying the foundations for Guardiola at Barcelona. Now, at the same time, Jose Mourinho has been a translator and then an assistant coach for Bobby Robson, who succeeded Johan Cruyff, and then he stays on with Van Gaal. That's his coaching education. That's where his ideas begin to be formed, although they take a very different route to many people about Barcelona. And he leaves Barcelona with Van Gaal, goes away, and this at Chelsea is when he really is beginning to assert himself.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's, as you say, it's 11 years since we spoke last time. And John, 11 years is a long time in football. And as Jonathan said there, a lot can happen. But this was when, I suppose, the English public certainly really saw, and you could argue the sort of the wider public as well, really saw a certain Jose Mourinho coming into the character that we know all too well now.
Yeah, I think Jose Mourinho, funny enough, I remember the first time I ever heard of Jose Mourinho, it was an interview with Bobby Robson talking about this protege of his that was a manager of at Porto, and he called him Zay. Like, that's a nickname that I've never not heard.
Is that short for Zen?
You know? I think it's Jose, but yeah. Zay. So, you know, so Zay, in, I think that's sort of 2002, 2003, of course, when he won the UEFA Cup with Porto, suddenly, within the space of two or three years, suddenly became, you know, the self-styled best coach in the world, the sharp-dressed man, all the rest of it. But this tie, we saw signs of the chilled out entertainer becoming the malevolence that we know and love
aggressive
for
protagonist
these days. Yes.
Yeah, that's right, isn't it, Jonathan? That obviously you write a lot about Jose Mourinho and have done over the years about almost being this kind of fallen angel figure at Barcelona. But this is where, you know, he was sort of poking his head a little bit above the parapet and revealing his true inner thoughts and feelings with regards to where he sits in the Barcelona legacy story.
Yeah, I mean, this is the first time he plays against Barcelona, having left them. So he leaves in 2000, and that was actually relatively non-acrimonious. that his contract had come to an end. Van Gaal had left. Mm-hmm. So yeah, he in that season leading up to that summer had been very clear. He felt it was time for him to go it alone and become a coach in his own right. He goes to Portugal. I mean, what happened in Portugal is actually itself extraordinary.
It is, absolutely.
But he gets a job as an assistant coach at Benfica. Benfica churns through managers incredibly quickly. So, you know, he pretty much knew he was going to get a chance at the main job there. Does very well, but then there's a presidential election and the new man coming in doesn't offer him the contract he wants. And then there's this great story. He's driving back to Setúbal, you know, his hometown, and he's going over this bridge in a storm and he feels the car being pulled by the wind. And that's the moment at which he thinks, you know, life's short. I've got to seize my opportunity. And he walks out. You know, his last game was beating Sporting 3-0, this great result. But he felt the Benfica board weren't backing him. He steps down a level, goes to Unión de Leiria, where he's very, very successful, given the constraints on the club. And on the back of that, gets a job at Porto. And, you know, the malevolence that John speaks of, I think this game is actually probably the worst thing he did. But it's there at Porto. So, for instance, the semi-final of UEFA Cup in 2003. So you'll remember the final when they beat Celtic.
Yeah.
In that amazing game in Seville, and one of the best games, one of the greatest atmospheres. Yeah, I've covered a game in, and Martin O'Neill, the Celtic manager that day, was you know, very annoyed by his Porto's time wasting and
their antics of some of the players. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, if you've got Boba Balde in your team kicking lumps out of people, whether you're really going to take them all the high ground, I'm not sure. But actually, the semi final was much worse. That Porto were 4-1 up at home to Lazio, and Lucas Castromán, the Argentinian, goes to take a throw in. And Mourinho basically knocks the ball away from him to waste time to stop a quick break. And he's banned for the second leg. And in a trope that will become increasingly familiar, he ends up sitting in the stand trying to work out how he can pass messages to his players. So he's sitting there in the Olympico in Rome. And
he didn't go in the laundry basket that time?
Not the laundry basket this time, but he's sitting there with André Villas-Boas, who is his assistant, not too far away, giving instructions. And André Villas-Boas is texting them down to the bench. Now, that's completely in kind of contravention of UEFA's regulations. And Mourinho's so proud of this cleverness that in Luis Lorenzo's biography, which is clearly written with Mourinho's, maybe help's too strong a word, but his support, you know, the texts are all there. It's just his transcription. There's no sort of shame at this. And then, of course, you know, these sort of slightly underhand tactics become much worse in this game as he... In the first leg, after the first leg, he accuses the referee Anders Frisk of having been visited at half time by Frank Rijkaard, the Barcelona manager. And there's no evidence that happened. What did happen was that Rijkaard approached Frisk as everybody left the pitch at half time, which you see very often. He felt that Damien Duff had been offside in the build up to the opening goal. Yeah, that happens a million times a season. The accusation that he went into the referee's dressing room, which is completely illegal. That took things to a new level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and John, with Mourinho, I think in England we were a little bit unaware of all these kind of antics. But as Jonathan said, it's all there. His whole time in Portugal, where he cleaned up, of course, at Porto, winning Champions League, UEFA Cup as it was then, and league titles, and the Taça de Portugal, and so on. But it was all there. You know, we shouldn't have really been surprised had we have sort of scratched the surface of the character of this man.
Oh yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone was. Too many people thought that, you know, this was an all-round nice guy. He was already... I'm researching for this game 2 weeks before this. He'd accused Alex Ferguson of trying to speak to a referee at half-time. You know, this was part of the playbook. He'd already set off on his own personal duels with Arsene Wenger, with Alex Ferguson. You know, this is a guy who... won by his own means, and sometimes those means were not to the approval of his rivals, and certainly winding up the opposition, specifically Seville that Jonathan talks about there. I actually watched that game in a pub full of Celtic fans. Now, every time a Porto player lay on the ground, and there was quite a lot of those, the absolute rage that ensued in there was absolutely incredible.
If he knew about that rage, which I'm sure he's well aware of, he absolutely loves it.
That's what he thrived on. Yeah. And
well, I mean, he was all very clear that for him, the next match begins at the end of 90 minutes of the previous match.
Yeah.
His press conference is the start of the next match.
Yeah.
And he's always been very, very, very open about that.
Mm.
And I think what's really disturbing about the Frisk incident, you could just about say that you know, he was trying to put pressure on referees. And you know, Chelsea do get a huge decision in the second leg from Pierluigi Collina, mm-hmm. from a referee. The winning goal from John Terry was a clear block from Ricardo Carvalho on Victor Valdes. Now, I'm pretty sure it was just that Collina, who probably was the least susceptible to any referee at the time to external pressure, I'm pretty sure he just didn't see it. But you do think, did he half see it and think, oh, I don't want to be another ref who's going against Jose? And you wonder if that pressure did have an impact.
Yeah, you'd hope not, but you can't dismiss it completely.
But then Frisk gets death threats. He talks about he won't let his children leave the house. He's so terrified. Frisk, you know, has been struck by a missile in a Roma game in the Champions League earlier that season. So Frisk's already sort of a little bit vulnerable. And you know, we remember him as sort of this sort of slightly ridiculous sort of, it's the highlights in his hair. He sort of strutted about. He liked being the centre of attention, but he's a good referee. And because of these death threats, he's forced to retire. He's 42.
Yeah.
And Mourinho's ended his career. Now, you could just about mount an argument that Mourinho's still a young coach. He perhaps doesn't quite realise the dangers of making claims such as that he made, that Rijkaard had visited him. But a month after this game, all this has happened with Frisk. He's had death threats, he's retired. There's Mourinho on Portuguese TV. He's asked about refereeing decision, and he says, well, I can't tell you what I think because I don't want a referee to get death threats.
Yeah, I mean,
he's making a joke about ending a man's career.
Yeah.
Yeah, no contrition.
Yeah.
No willingness to take responsibility for his actions. And so, from my point of view, I was working for Financial Times at the time, covering Jose in his first season. There'd been this sort of, oh, this guy's great. You know, he's funny. He says things other people don't say. You go to his press conference, you know, you're going to get great material. And we sort of warmed to that. You know, he's sort of like, Richard III figure that, okay, we know he's a wrong'un, but at least he's a funny wrong'un.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
And then he does that, and you sort of think, actually, this is a bit more serious.
And I think that's been the pattern of his career at every club he's been at. I've covered him a lot when he went back to Chelsea the second time. For the first 3-4 months, laugh-a-minute stuff, you know, playing up to the crowd, joking along, being very friendly to journalists, plenty of, great one-liners. But when the hammer goes down, that's when the malevolent side comes out. And it is normally in high-pressure fixtures like this, and, as the point of this discussion is, he's going back against the club, which he feels rejected by perhaps a little bit, feels that, he's got plenty to prove to them. Jose Mourinho isn't the type of guy who's going to sort of open his arms and be friendly. I want to get one over them. I'll be friendly afterwards, maybe.
Yeah, and everything he does is very much in his own interest. But you mentioned a little bit earlier, Jonathan, about the press conferences and the next game starts after the 90 minutes. And of course, going back to the Champions League tie in 2005 between Chelsea and Barcelona, ahead of the first leg in Barcelona, he names the whole Barcelona starting 11.
It's this incredible trick of this is the team they're going to play.
Yeah.
And he gets it right.
And he was right, yeah.
And the chutzpah to do that is incredible. But it's also, it's sort of saying that I know this club inside out. There's nothing they can do is going to surprise me. Look how ridiculous and predictable they are. This is what they're going to do.
So it's partly that not a sort tribute of, to Andre Villas-Boas' scouting?
And I'm sure he paid him full credit.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Well,
yeah.
I'm sure AVB paid himself full credit.
I'm sure AVB did, yeah. So it's not just sort of showing off and saying that I know this incredibly well. It's also demeaning Barcelona. It's sort of undermining them. And that, I think, is fine. I think that example of using the press conference to sort of suggest, come on, I'm better than this lot. I know exactly what they're going to do. I don't have a problem with that.
Mm.
And that's good, Jose.
Yeah. But and right, that was Mourinho, where he had the a kind of an air of mystique, of almost sort of wizardry around him when he would do things like that. You know, I think Vitor Baia said
when
he was in Portugal, the tactics he gave when he said, did he predict that the referee was going to send one of their players
off? Yeah, there was a game against Benfica where Mourinho, according to Vitor Baia, Mourinho said, look, we know this referee, we know the pressure that the crowd are going to put on him, he will send one of ours off, so when we get one man sent off, this is how we'll play.
Oh, that's remarkable.
And he also said, we will take the lead, and this is a substitution that Benfica will make. And sure enough, that happened. And so, his level of preparation, his understanding of certain aspects of the psychology of the game was so great that Vita Baez said, you know, it felt like he could see the future. It felt as a player that you could trust this guy because he knows not only what he's doing now, but he knows what other people are going to do afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, you see that again at Chelsea, the first time they played PSG in the Champions League. And John Terry said afterwards that he'd prepared them every conceivable scoreline for the substitutions he would make. And they end up winning that game on away goals with a very late Demba Ba goal. Mm. But Terry afterwards said, we weren't really worried because we knew we had a plan for every situation.
Yeah.
The wizardry, the sense of something mystical is definitely there, but it's founded in preparation.
Of course, absolutely right. And you can't ignore that, because often we... You know, we're all guilty in the media and the press and so on of just looking at Mourinho in his personal characteristics and so on. But there's an amazing football coach there, lest we forget. I mean, always wants to make himself at the centre of attention and so on and so forth. But when we talk about this thorough preparation and so on, this guy, as we said, won the Champions League with Porto and so on, won Chelsea their first Premier League title, is one of the best coaches in the modern era of football.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
There's no doubt about that, but I do think we're currently, the way that we look at Mourinho is slightly through a different lens because of the way that things have maybe gone at Manchester United, because of the way that things went at Chelsea. But yes, it certainly go back to, I mean, I actually think that the finest points of his career are what he did at Porto. Winning the Champions League with Porto is almost now an unachievable thing. It's almost like a Leicester winning the Premier League, and actually Inter Milan as well.
Mm-hmm.
What you have with Jose Mourinho is that ability to be something of the other, a rebel working outside the system. Now, Barcelona are the establishment club that he worked at before, but now he's with Chelsea, a club who are owned by a, let's say, shady Russian billionaire. there is money coming in, and a club, actually, Chelsea, who will change the face of European football in this era of financial fair play, and make clubs like Barcelona, Real Madrid, Bayern Munich sit up and think, hang on, that's the way that the clubs are being funded in a way that we can't do. And if Mourinho fits a club like Chelsea, I think actually if his better achievements were at those other clubs, I think Chelsea was the ideal club for him, just of that sort of rebel instinct that he had at that time.
Absolutely. And you mentioned he's a rebel. Well, he's a rebel with a cause, Jonathan, of course. And that all stems from Barcelona, his time at Barcelona.
Yeah, in this sense that he was not fully appreciated there. You know, they called him the translator. And, he was more than that, but I think he needed to be told he was more than that. So what's fascinating about him, I think particularly this period, 2005, is you see the movement from Barca Jose to modern Jose, and this is sort of a midpoint. So you know, he's learned under Robson, he's learned under Van Gaal. He's learned a style of play that's based on these Cruyffian principles. And as his career goes on, he slowly turns them on his, on the head. So the whole Cruyff thing, if you have a ball, the opposition can't score. You just keep the ball and you won't lose the game. Mourinho, famously, he who has the ball has fear. It's the exact opposite. So there's this sort of, as a paradox, you sort of think of him as being, you know, nothing to do with Cruyff. You almost think that these principles are so removed from Cruyff, how can they have come from the same source? And yet he's thinking in the same way, he's just turned them around. It's not like Simeone or not like Klopp, who's come from something totally different, whose conception of the game is different. The conception of the game's the same. He just draws different lessons.
So what you're saying, Jonathan, it's like a misanthropic interpretation of Cruyff values then?
Yeah.
He thought, because of the way they rejected me,
I'm going to
turn it around.
And I think that fully happens after 2008 when he doesn't get the job, when Guardiola gets the Barca job. But you see his Porto team, and they do press high up the pitch. Mm. I mean, of course, it's a different situation, a different league. It's an easier league.
Yeah.
But they do press high up the pitch. They do play actually quite attractive football. They can mix it, and they can certainly practice the dark arts. But they're fundamentally quite a good footballing team to watch. That first Chelsea side is actually quite good to watch. It's got a lot
of goals.
People
forget that. You know, I mean,
and you look at the... I mean, maybe we should say what actually happens in this tie. So,
yeah.
But Barcelona win the first game 2-1. Drogba is... Well, Chelsea take the lead with a Belletti own goal in the first half. Drogba sent off about 10 minutes in the second half. He'd already been booked. A slightly reckless challenge on Victor Valdes, which on another day he might have got away with, but, you know, it's not a scandalous decision. He sent off... And then Maxi Lopez and Samuel Eto'o score twice in quick succession to give Barca a 2-1 win. Back at Stamford Bridge, that first 20 minutes of Stamford Bridge is, I think, the best I've ever seen Chelsea play. I mean, they are absolutely magnificent. Playing a 4-4-2, and if you think of that, the people in that 4-4-2, it's actually an incredibly attacking side. It's incredibly un-Jose that they, you know, the midfield, okay, Makélélé holding, but Lampard alongside him, obviously pushing forward. Joe Cole on the right, Damien Duff on the left. And then because Drogba's suspended, you've got Adegard Janssen and Mateo Kesman up front. And that first 20 minutes, they score three times. Joe Cole is absolutely magnificent. And it's the sort of pace and directness of Joe Cole, which may, I mean, certainly in my head, that was not the sort of player he was. And you look back at the highlights of it, you think, it's Joseph got Joe Cole playing like that. And the third goal is such a lovely break. And the calmness of, I mean, the ball sort of bounces quite awkwardly for Joe Cole, who cushions it down for Damien Duff's run. And then his incredibly casual first-time finish. And in that moment, you sort of thought, this is done. This is not just done, it's absolutely amazing. They scored three times in 8 or 9 minutes. And they're now 4-2 up in aggregate. But what then happens... Barcelona get a penalty for a handball by Paulo Ferreira. Ronaldinho scores. Ronaldinho scores the famous goal where he sort of uses Ricardo Carvalho as a shield and sort of stabs it around Carvalho in the bottom corner.
Toe punch, Jonathan.
A toe punch, yeah.
It doesn't
so
mean
it's 3-2 on the night. It's 4-4 on aggregate. Barca have the lead on away goals. And then Chelsea win it with a John Terry header from a corner where Carvalho blocks off Victor Valdes. And so, once again... Brilliant 20 minutes, but it's actually the dark arts that win it. But anyway, the point being, this is actually a very attacking side he picks. It's not. I can't imagine his Manchester United would approach a similar situation, a similar game, in a similar way.
Mm-hmm.
So to play with that pace, that sense of adventure, he hasn't reached curmudgeonly Jose over later years.
Yeah, and it's true, John, isn't it? That it was a scintillating performance, and sometimes we think of Mourinho, as Jonathan touched on there, as being a bit of a boring coach these days. But they did have a bit of the kind of attacking flair, if you like, which we often associate with the likes of Barcelona and so on and so forth in those early days at Chelsea.
Yeah, and I think Chelsea, at that point, what Mourinho had done with that team, he'd bought Paulo Ferreira, Ricardo Carvalho from Porto, and then they'd pretty much started stockpiling talent from other English clubs, Duff, Joe Cole, obviously Frank Lampard, who was already at the club, and then brought him, I mean, Kesman, actually, I'd forgotten that he actually played for Chelsea.
Yeah, came in from PSV.
But a negligible presence. But they stockpiled strikers. They had a lot of forward players.
Well, it's interesting, they then signed Deco.
Yes.
So, yeah, they actually take a player from our Barcelona team.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've been with Jose at Porto, but I think that suggests the sort of similarity that a Barcelona player could fit in Jose's Chelsea.
Mm-hmm. But why then? You mentioned, of course, earlier there that his sort of the Jose Mourinho we know now was quite, I suppose, shaped in his that kind of rebel with a cause attitude was when he was turned down for the Barcelona job. But this was a few years before it. Why then do you think that Mourinho still had those that kind of slight rebellious, slightly anti-Barcelona feeling before he'd been rejected? Because bearing in mind, that was the job he wanted.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting because I think you're right. I think you see the traces of that before the rejection. And I think he just always felt like an outsider, that everybody else he was working with at Barcelona had a great career as a player, and he hadn't. And I think even now that eats him up. I think that his non-playing career is something that psychologically weighs heavily on him. And so, you know, I know we're going to come on to talk about this in a future podcast, but the 2010 semi-final when his Inter beat Barca, his celebration at the end of that, he runs across the pitch with his finger in the air,
yeah,
like a striker scoring a goal.
Yeah,
you don't see many managers behaving like that. You know, he wants to be one of the lads. He wants to be a player, and he never was. So I can understand, you know, if you're at Barcelona and Louis van Gaal, who okay, his playing career was decent without being great, but it's, you know, has done great things with Ajax. You know, he's a star presence. The other assistant manager is Ronald Koeman. You're one of the most successful players of all time, one of the greatest ball-playing defenders of all time, one of the great goal-scoring defenders. And you look at that team and you've got people like Pep Guardiola, who is not merely a great player, but is talking about tactics in an incredibly sort of sophisticated way, even at that stage. You can understand why Joseph thinks, these people aren't listening to me. They don't trust me. They don't believe in me. And I think that sense, you know, the fact he was always the translator, I think that irritated him and led to the ill feeling.
Yeah.
I think there's two things. I think at this point he probably still did think, I could go back to Barcelona. He definitely thought that. I could go back to Barcelona and be their manager. Now, what's the way that you prove to a club that you can do the job is you beat them. Mm. Now, another of his ambitions we've known for a long time is managing Manchester United. He used to absolutely love beating Manchester United. Would be quite respectful to the club afterwards, but beating Manchester United was a big part of it. And I think what Jonathan says about but being a professional, I think the way that Mourinho, the players that he's been close to, have always been the hard professionals. Those ones with natural talent, I think he's always struggled with. The latest example of that might be Anthony Martial at Manchester United. But you've got those players like Frank Lampard, a player who, okay, was born into a football family, but maybe not the most talented player. Materazzi at Inter. You've got those players, the hard professionals. Those are the people I think that Jose Mourinho aspires to be like, and he wants to be a lad like them. You know, Pepe. There's so many players like that he wants to be the hard-bitten professional. He doesn't want to be the airy-fairy Lionel Messi.
Well, he spoke, didn't he? He said Drogba was him on the pitch.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And Drogba, there's a guy who, you know, started his career late, had to fight his way through, is still playing football now for his love of the game. And I think that's Mourinho's sort of enthusiasm, is the proper pro. Someone who wasn't born to be this. Because I think the thing about Mourinho, it always is, if anything is... It's slightly odd because he is from a footballing family. His dad was a manager and all that.
Well, and a goalkeeper, decent goalkeeper.
Yeah, and it wasn't as if, like, he had nothing to do with football. It's slightly twisting his own narrative a little bit
also,
about that.
Well, also, his family was very, very affluent.
Well, of course, yeah.
He wasn't, you know, his first experience of football wasn't a kick about in the streets and the slums. It was taking shots at a servant in his great uncle's huge estate.
Well,
they lost it under Salazar, but you know, still.
I thought you were going to say he lost the kickabout. You know?
And I think this is a very good point by John, because I think, you know, what's the opposite of that in managerial terms? Who's somebody who hasn't worked their way up the hard way? It's Frank Rijkaard. He's looking at Barcelona and going, they've just appointed a great player. Mm. Frank Rijkaard's, you know, ends his playing career, sets up an underwear company, somehow becomes Netherlands national team manager. Gets them to the semi-final of Euro 2000, and that's it. So on home soil, they only get to the semi-final.
It was a disappointing finish for them, yeah.
Yeah. You're losing to Italy in that semi-final. He then relegates Sparta Rotterdam, and he's then about to become coach of the Netherlands Antilles. I mean, the Netherlands Antilles gets snubbed for Barcelona.
Rijkaard's CV is incredible, you know, and it is evidence to massively back up this Barcelona legacy philosophy kind of thing. Because as you say, and even from there, he went to Turkey. I think he got sacked. It's such an anomaly.
But, yeah, his managerial career is a disaster, apart from winning the Champions League and laying the foundations for the great Barcelona we now know.
Yeah, I mean, we absolutely. He was the precursor to Pep Guardiola because they played beautiful football. It's such a strange one.
And he re-established that Dutch Cruyffian influence. Yeah, they'd been adrift away under Serra Ferrer and Rexach. Mm-hmm. And he re-established that specifically by bringing in Edgar Davids midway through that season on loan. And you know, Xavi, for instance, says that, you know, playing alongside Davids for, I think it's only something like 16 games that Davids played there. I mean, in the sort of high teens, anyway. And Xavi said, you know, that was actually the most important moment of his career. And you know, Xavi's phrase was, "Davids taught me how to die for this cause." So the idea of Cruyffianism as this you know, cause to die for, you know, it's Rijkaard who establishes that. Mm. And I think particularly in the February, because you know, Rijkaard had come in. The previous summer, they had a really bad start of the season. There was a lot of talk around Christmas of him getting sacked. Davids comes in, the results pick up. They actually end up almost winning the league. I think they lost two of the last three games. And if he'd won them, he would have won the league. But at that point in February, Barcelona are adrift in La Liga. So you can understand Mourinho looking at Barcelona going, what on earth is this club doing? Just appointing one of their philosophers, or one of the pupils of their philosophers, rather than turning to somebody like me, he's just won the Champions League with Porto. Mm.
But what an appointment it was, John, because as we say there, Rijkaard got that side playing beautiful stuff, and without Rijkaard, would Pep Guardiola have been able to kind of do what he went on to do with Barcelona?
I mean, the thing is, at this time, Barcelona were the team that you would set aside time to watch on TV, because they really were excellent, I mean, especially after Davids joined. That spell from January through to the end of the season, absolutely magnificent. The thing is with Rijkaard, I think the difference between him and what came after with Pep Guardiola, it's the individual. I think it's that Rijkaard relied on individual talents. He had Ronaldinho pretty much approaching his apex, obviously Deco, players like that. What happened was those players went stale. Guardiola came in, and then it was far more systemic. And then, of course, I mean, the following season, actually, when Chelsea played Barcelona again, there was this guy called Lionel Messi played on the right wing. And so that obviously changed things quite a lot. But what you've got between the difference between Rijkaard, I suspect that Rijkaard is not as adept a coach as Pep Guardiola or as dedicated to it. It seems like a happy accident, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
But you've got a club that was actually reforming at the time, haven't you? Laporta was switching things around. Remember the documentary at the time BBC showed? It was one of the, you know, which just showed that the club was modernising, was working out how to change itself around. And, you know, sometimes it can happen for coaches. And at this point, other clubs would have thought Rijkaard would be a great manager. But by the time it fell apart at Barcelona, very few people would have looked.
And of course, the other thing, you see the hand of Cruyff in the background.
Yes.
That you know, Laporta would replace Gaspar as president in the summer 2004.
Yeah.
But who's actually pulling the strings? It's Cruyff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Rijkaard doesn't get that job because Laporta thinks he'll be a great coach. Rijkaard gets that job because Cruyff thinks he'll be a great coach.
Well, mm-hmm. Cruyff clearly thinks he can coach through Rijkaard.
Well, quite, yeah. Yes. He'll be a great mouthpiece, yeah. Rather than a great coach, perhaps.
And I think that's a good point to end it on there, gentlemen. Thank you very much indeed, John Bruno, and of course, Jonathan Wilson. That was the third of a six-part series to coincide with the release of The Barcelona Legacy, a book that explores how the evolution of today's game begins at Barcelona 25 years ago with the pioneering ideas of Johan Cruyff and was taken on by the likes of Louis van Gaal, Jose Mourinho, and Pep Guardiola. As I say, one more thank you to Jonathan Wilson, of course, the author of the book, and John Bruin, freelance football journalist. Thank you, gentlemen, and we'll see you next time.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.